In answer to Abu Hiram, who encountered Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and inquired of the reason for his movement and leaving Mecca to Iraq, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that actually he had been wronged by the Umayyads, and indicated that the Umayyads did all sorts of, exerted all sorts of pressures on him. First of all, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that the Umayyads actually tried to defame him, and then they exerted much pressure on him and made the Medinan context and space very much agitated and far from secure for him. And in Mecca, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam sensed that the Umayyads were intent to kill him in Mecca. So there was no way out for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his people to leave Mecca out. To leave Mecca and to move toward Karbala, toward Al-Kufa, in fact. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam anticipated that after the Umayyads would certainly slay him, martyr him, the Umayyads will be turned into one of the most abased people, such that even the least respect wouldn't be left for them. And Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that those Umayyads who would kill him will be very much despised. And it was indeed a truthful anticipation of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, because we find that after a couple of years after the Karbala incident, al-Mukhtar al-Thaqafi worked out a revolt and summoned and collected those criminals who slew Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. In this connection, we find that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam's anticipation was correct. It wasn't anything imaginary. So we find that in the anticipations of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, it was a certain remark, a certain anticipation that came true in the revolt of al-Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The top prize of the Islamic Human Rights Awards goes to Shirin Abu Akla. The former Al Jazeera journalist was shot dead by Israeli forces back in May while reporting Tel Aviv's atrocities against Palestinians. Her name echoed in the 7th edition of Islamic Human Rights and Dignity Awards. Shirin was awarded for her vital role in shining a light on the Palestinian cause in her on-the-scene reports from the occupied territories.
Shirin was killed by an Israeli bullet. There's also criticism directed at the U.S. Israel is pushing the United States to avoid introducing the Tel Aviv regime as the killer of Shirin Abu Akleh. But we at Al Jazeera will continue our investigation of the case to bring her assassin to justice.
Another winner of the Islamic Human Rights Awards was Mandla Mandela, the grandson of former South African President Nelson Mandela. Mandla, who is now serving as a member of South Africa's National Assembly, won the award for his active role in opposing the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
The Palestinian issue is of greatest importance to us, as we have seen the atrocities that are being meted out against defenseless children, women, who are languishing in Israeli jails, as well as Palestinians in general. And we continue to expose the apartheid regime of Israel as carrying out crimes against humanity and genocide against the Palestinian people.
Organized by the Iranian Judiciary's Human Rights Committee, the event was held on the occasion of the 32nd anniversary of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam. In 1990, member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference assembled in Cairo and laid out a new human rights charter that sought to ensure man's freedom and right to dignity in accordance with Islamic laws.
Activists here say the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights states that every human being, regardless of race and religion, has the right to a dignified life, something which they say the West has so far not lived up to.
Observers say the West, and on top of them the U.S., maintains a selective approach toward human rights, to an extent that it violates even its own principles of human rights.
For example, you see that in Canada, how they are treating the indigenous people. They are their own people, and the rights are violated. Or in the United States, so you see that how they are treating with the blacks. So they are also, again, their own people. So for them, it doesn't matter whether it is Islamic human rights or the international human rights or the Western human rights principles.
The imposition of sanctions as a punishing leverage is another example cited by participants here as a blatant violation of human rights by Washington.
The sanctions that have been imposed on the Islamic Republic are secondary sanctions imposed by the United States, not by the United Nations. South Africa itself does not observe these sanctions. We don't recognize them.
Participants say the Islamic narrative of human rights is not meant to be a counterpoint to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it seeks to safeguard the rights of Muslims against any misuse by countries such as the U.S., which looks at the issue through the lens of its political interests. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Two days after several explosions rocked the northern neighborhood of Wazir Akbar Khan in the Afghan capital Kabul, the U.S. claims the CIA successfully targeted a safe house there, killing al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. The pressure is again on people, as unfortunately, it has become very common to wake up to the sound of explosions every morning.
It was 6 o'clock in the morning when a strong explosion shocked us. We were working here and saw the smoke. I don't know the cause of the blast, but Taliban did not let anyone get close to the area.
At first, the Taliban claimed that the explosions were caused by blind rockets. Now that the drone strike has been confirmed, the Taliban condemn it and consider it a violation of Afghan sovereignty and the Doha Agreement signed between them and the U.S. They also stressed that the targeted house was empty during the raid and that there were no casualties.
As it is about sovereignty of Afghanistan, no country has the right to attack Afghanistan with manned or unmanned planes. The statements that the U.S. is making on al-Zawahiri are just claims. The U.S. does what it wants by force.
The recent airstrike in Kabul has now stoked fears among people. They are scared that such incidents might happen more and more frequently, as they witnessed 10 members of a family, including 6 children, were targeted a year ago in a drone strike before the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. The Afghan people are most shocked by what happened. They say their land has become a hotspot for settling international accounts they have nothing to do with. But, as always, they have to bear the brunt of such incidents. Abdullah Amirzadeh from Kabul.
La- Lebanon's leaders have once more met with the U.S. Energy Envoy, who is in Beirut for talks. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati, and Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri have reportedly given the envoy a unified Lebanese proposal, which the envoy will be taking to the Israeli side for a response. Amos Hochstein told reporters after the meeting that he was optimistic that a demarcation agreement will be reached in the coming weeks.
I remain optimistic that we can make continuous progress as we have over the last several weeks, and I look forward to coming back to the region and being able to make the final arrangement.
This comes one day after Hezbollah's resistance movement released footage of gas barges in the Quraysh field, their coordinates and a surface-to-sea missile, warning the Israelis that wasting time is not beneficial.
The video released by the resistance will strengthen Lebanon's position as a party in the talks and will give the three leaders a new bargaining chip, just like the Hezbollah drones help move the talks forward and bring Hochstein back to Lebanon. The coming hours will be decisive, and we will see realistic steps and will most probably go back to indirect talks in Nahura. But we have very little time.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also repeated that all Hezbollah wants in this file is to help Lebanon and give the state elements of strength in the negotiations.
If we cannot drill and take out our wealth, so nobody else will do. And we are waiting until we see if Hochstein has in his trip to Lebanon any solution to lift off all the sanctions against Lebanon.
Said Nasrallah said in light of the outcome, Hezbollah will decide how to act in the coming period. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun has stressed that he will not be lenient when it comes to Lebanon's right to its natural resources. He also said he will no longer accept that Lebanon be the subject of discrimination as it has in the past. The statement is backed by what seems to be a new strategy by the resistance, which could give Lebanon the upper hand in the maritime talks. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Prince Charles, Britain's heir to the throne, in yet more hot water for accepting questionable donations to his charitable fund, this time from a family whose name brings back horrifying memories. Bakr and Shafiq bin Laden, wealthy construction magnates and half-brothers of the dead Al-Qaeda terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, reportedly donated $1.7 million to a charitable fund that the prince is the patron of.
The future king allegedly greenlighted the donation after meeting one of the bin Laden brothers in the palatial building known as Clarence House in 2013, only 2 years after U.S. Special Forces killed a 9/11 mastermind in the east of Pakistan.
The prince's office denies any wrongdoing, saying the decision to accept the money was made by the fund's trustees. To those observing the royal family for years, something bigger is at play.
What I think is happening is in Britain at the moment, we're in a transition going from the Elizabethan age, if you will, to a new era in the royal family, which is Prince Charles. And I think what they're doing is cleaning out the closet and getting rid of any skeletons which could shadow or cast a shadow over his accession to the throne.
In February, claims of a cash for honor scandal involving a Saudi businessman, a police investigation into another of Charles's charitable foundations ensued. And before that, reports that between 2011 and 2015, the prince accepted donations totaling $3.2 million to his charity from a former Qatari prime minister, with the cash delivered in shopping bags.
The optics aren't good. And if this money was being received in the Kremlin or in Tehran or another country that's at odds with the West, you can imagine the outcry and the pompous invective that would be spouted towards those countries.
It remains to be seen if the prince will be investigated over this latest revelation. And with an upcoming documentary featuring the life of his deceased former wife, Princess Diana, scrutiny of the 73-year-old royal will intensify. Saeed Purza, London.
A
Under the title Blockade on Yemen, Slow Killing of Civilians Under the UN Cover, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in Yemen's capital Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemen despite the UN brokered truce.
The United Nations participates directly and indirectly in the killing of the Yemeni people by its silence on the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. Saudi Arabia is violating the terms of the UN armistice, and unfortunately, the international body has not taken any action. And there are falsification of facts and allegations that the Saudi-led coalition cares about the humanitarian situation in Yemen, and this is not true.
Officials say the United Nations is responsible for the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen throughout the armistice, as it has failed to force Riyadh to fulfill its obligations under the agreement.
The United Nations is the one who monitors and inspects all ships, including food, medicine, and oil ships, but it does not inspect Saudi ships that carry weapons, and all Yemeni ships are prevented from reaching the Hodeidah port. We believe that the United Nations is responsible for what happens to civilians in Yemen because of its inability to force Riyadh to abide by the terms of the armistice brokered by the international body.
Recently, Yemenis have demonstrated in front of the United Nations Envoy's office in Sana'a to criticize Riyadh's continued detention of Yemeni fuel ships amid the UN brokered truce.
Human rights activists believe the Saudi violations of the UN brokered truce will not stop unless the world body takes real measures against the kingdom. They say the terms of the armistice should be completely fulfilled before any extension. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar, is round the corner. Like in other parts of the world, people here in Kashmir, the only Muslim-majority region in India, are also gearing up for annual Muharram ceremonies. Roads and streets are draped with black flags and banners in remembrance of Imam Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his faithful companions who were massacred in the desert plains of Karbala in 680 AD. Painter and calligrapher Shaukat Ahmad is busy these days, preparing banners to be used in mourning rituals. The banners are in huge demand, as they are the integral part of Muharram ceremonies here. The Imam Bargahs, which are congregation halls for Shia commemoration ceremonies, are also being covered with black sheets and banners. The main Muharram commemorations are held in Imam Bargahs, where Kashmiri Marsiyas, elegiac poems written to commemorate Imam Hussein and his companions, are recited. Also, scholars deliver sermons to highlight the significance of Ashura uprising. Ashura is the 10th day of Muharram when Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq 14 centuries ago.
While mourning ceremonies are held in different areas with sizable Shia population, the two major processions in the capital city Srinagar on 8th of Muharram and its 10th day, known as Ashura, were banned in 1990. Despite repeated pleas by religious and political bodies to lift the ban, the authorities remain unmoved.
Muharram processions will be allowed only on the already permitted routes. All those concerned have also been requested to hold processions through those routes only.
The authorities claim the traditional processions in Srinagar pose security threats. The religious bodies and civil activists, on the other hand, term the ban as, quote, blatant breach of religious freedom.
These processions were a symbol of unity, as thousands of Sunnis would participate with Shias in these processions. On the one hand, authorities say that the situation in Kashmir has been back to normal, but on the other hand, they are not allowing such religious processions to take place under the pretext that they would create law and order problems.
The state provides security to Amarnath Yatra that attracts tens of thousands of Hindu pilgrims. And on the other hand, it curbs the historic Muharram processions as well as the celebrations to mark Eid Milad, the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad, in the city center. This speaks volumes about the gross discrimination against the Muslim majority population here.
Every year, despite the clampdown in the region, mourners defy the restrictions and try to carry out the Muharram processions, but they are tear gassed, cane charged, and detained. With around 1.5 million population, Shias constitute 10% of the total population of India's only Muslim-majority region, which lies at the heart of more than 70 years of hostility between India and Pakistan. Said Ali Safi, Indian administered Kashmir.
In a major blow to freedom of the press, the European Union's second highest court has upheld the ban on Russian media outlet RT France for alleged disinformation. Launched in 2017 with a 20 million euro budget and well over 100 employees, RT France burst onto the scene with reporting that the billionaire-dominated French mainstream media refused to touch. Their coverage of the Yellow Vest social revolt won widespread praise. They rejected the total Western media blackout on the movement, which began in June 2019.
Providing news is a public service and an obligation of every state. Therefore, it is entirely legitimate for a state to contribute to the budget of medias so that their citizens have balanced, objective information according to their own point of view.
It was no surprise that President Emmanuel Macron was the first leader to call for a Europe-wide ban on Russian state media. The French government then orchestrated the rapid implementation of the ban less than a week after Russia started its military operation in Ukraine.
It's dramatic when you ban alternative news sources, which haven't even broken any laws. There has been no slander or racism or calls for violence, and yet they're denied freedom of expression. It's a dramatic problem for France and Europe, and compounded by the fact that there is absolutely no alternative point of view permitted or available in French media.
The fact that freedom of the press is granted to far-right media such as the Islamophobic Charlie Hebdo magazine, but denied to the Russian people, has already left its impression. The citizens of France and Europe have not been allowed to hear both sides of the long-running conflict in Ukraine. This one-sided media domination has allowed European elite to whip up Russophobia and war hysteria unopposed, and provided them with the opportunity to impose unprecedented economic and diplomatic pressure on Moscow. Upon relinquishing the EU's rotating presidency in June, Macron was criticized for saying that the unrest in Ukraine accelerated the bloc's collective agenda. The EU was criticized for once again relying on not democratic means to achieve political ends. A final appeal by RT France to the European Court of Justice is expected to fail as well. In 2012, on the orders of the European Commission, Press TV was removed by top European satellite provider Eutelsat. Last year, the PressTV.com domain was seized and shut down by the United States federal government. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A new study has revealed a shocking disparity by British schools, which have gone to great lengths to promote Ukraine solidarity among their students, in stark contrast to how Palestinian solidarity is suppressed in the classroom. Human rights group CAGE carried out the survey, which received 532 responses from parents, students, and teachers. The group said the survey revealed a cavalier attitude to due diligence, including collaboration with organizations with far-right links and the soft penetration of security think tanks and those linked to the UK's so-called Prevent Counter-Extremism program. Some of the survey's findings include 96% of respondents confirming proactive engagement on the Ukraine issue by their school, including holding non-uniform days, activities, or donation appeals. 62% indicated their school had fundraised or hosted donation drives for Ukraine, while 17% also mentioned schools promote the Ukraine flag, such as hoisting the Ukrainian flag on school grounds. And perhaps most shockingly, alleged funding from some schools was intended to provide military gear for the war. In 2021, Israel's bombing of Gaza drew huge international backlash as millions took to the streets worldwide. British students also joined the outpouring of support for Palestine. However, British schools responded negatively, with students being punished for waving a Palestinian flag or branded racist in some cases for expressing solidarity.
For Palestine, supporting Palestine goes against British foreign policy interests. Support for Ukraine is in line with that, and hence that was allowed and encouraged. And the government even produced guidance for schools into how, and for parents into how they could do so. While for Palestine, the government minister for education at the time, Gavin Williamson, he issued a letter, clear letter to schools, indicating to them that discussion on Palestine needs to be clamped down or managed to such a degree where it can only ever amplify the pro-Israeli, pro-apartheid narrative.
In early July, London's High Court dismissed a legal challenge by Cage against the Department for Education over issuing so-called discriminatory guidance, which was then used by schools to censor and penalize any student who was willing to express solidarity with Palestine, particularly during Israel's bombardment of Gaza last year. This whole saga will have convinced many more that Britain may indeed be biased when looking at conflicts and human rights abuses abroad. Robert Carter, London.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. While candidates are free to challenge the results of their elections under various state guidelines, Trump-allied election officials pose a more insidious threat. Echoing the same false narratives as Donald Trump and his endorsed candidates, county officials in New Mexico, Nevada, and Pennsylvania have tried to circumvent state laws and refused to sign off on primary election results. We are prepared for you an article written by Igor Derish, a New York-based political writer. The piece is titled, GOP Officials in at least three states have refused to certify primary results. Please stay with us for more of Igor Derish's article. U.S. Republican election officials in at least three states have refused to certify primary votes in a sign of things to come amid the party's baseless election fraud crusade. Numerous allies of former President Donald Trump have echoed his lies about voter fraud on the campaign trail. Trump-backed Arizona gubernatorial candidate Kerry Lake and Nevada U.S. Senate candidate Adam Laxalt both claimed evidence of election stealing before any votes were cast. Colorado Secretary of State candidate Tina Peters has twice demanded recounts of her Republican primary race after losing by double digits. Nevada gubernatorial candidate Joey Gilbert filed a lawsuit alleging that his GOP primary loss was a mathematical impossibility, even after a recount he requested confirmed the results. While candidates are free to challenge the results of their elections under various state guidelines, Trump-allied election officials pose a more insidious threat. Echoing the same false narratives as Donald Trump and his endorsed candidates, County officials in New Mexico, Nevada, and Pennsylvania have tried to circumvent state laws and refused to sign off on primary results. Republican commissioners in Otero County, New Mexico, recently refused to certify primary results in their GOP-dominated jurisdiction, citing unspecified concerns about Dominion voting machines. These apparently stem from Trump World's crusade to stoke allegations that the machines had flipped votes from Trump to Joe Biden. The Otero County commissioners ultimately relented and certified the votes amid concerns that they could go to jail after state officials took them to court. Republican commissioners in rural Esmeralda County in Nevada likewise refused to certify the 317 votes cast in the county recently, citing unspecified concerns about the election from residents. County officials ultimately relented after spending more than 7 hours counting the 317 ballots by hand. Three Republican-led counties in Pennsylvania, Berks, Fayette, and Lancaster, have refused to count all valid votes from the May 17th primary election for Senate, Congress, Governor, and the state legislature for weeks over opposition to the state's rules regarding undated mail-in ballots. According to the Associated Press, officials in all three counties informed the state last month that they would not count mail-in votes that had not been properly dated. Pennsylvania mail ballots instruct voters to write a date next to their signature on the outside of mail-in return envelopes, although these dates do not determine whether voters are eligible or if votes were cast on time. A federal appeals court ruled in May that undated mail-in ballots must be counted, ruling that the dates are immaterial. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court, even with three Trump-appointed justices, allowed the ruling to stand. A state court similarly ruled in the Republican Senate primary that undated ballots should be counted. The Pennsylvania Department of State earlier this month sued the three counties, asking a state court to order them to include all valid ballots, even if the voter failed to write a date on the declaration printed on the ballot's return envelope. The department said in the lawsuit that the handwritten date is not necessary for any purpose, does not remedy any mischief, and does not advance any other objective, and that allowing just three county boards to exclude votes that all other county boards have included in their returns creates impermissible discrepancies in the administration of Pennsylvania's 2022 primary election. The Pennsylvania Department of State's lawsuit said interpreting Pennsylvania's law to allow a county board of election to exclude a ballot from its final certified results because of a minor and meaningless irregularity, such as a voter omitting a date from the declaration on a timely received ballot, would fail to fulfill the purpose of the Pennsylvania Election Code and would risk a conflict with both the Pennsylvania Constitution and federal laws. Molly Stiber, a spokeswoman for the state attorney general, Josh Shapiro, told the New York Times, "It is imperative that every legal vote cast by a qualified voter is counted," adding, "The 64 other counties in Pennsylvania have complied and accurately certified their election results. Counties cannot abuse their responsibility for running elections as an excuse to unlawfully disenfranchise voters. Berks County Commissioner Christian Leinbach said during an appearance in court on Thursday, 28th of July, that he does not have discretion to determine whether a date is material or immaterial. Claiming that rulings on the ballots have been anything but clear, he said during a hearing, "I simply am obliged to look at the clear language of the law that says undated and or unsigned ballots will not be counted." Christian Leinbach said he could not in good conscience vote to certify undated ballots, claiming that this type of issue is what is causing a lack of trust in the system. Lancaster County officials told the Philadelphia Inquirer the county had properly certified its results in accordance with state law and court orders. The county said the Commonwealth's demand is contrary to the law or any existing court order. The county will vigorously defend its position to follow the law to ensure the integrity of elections in Lancaster County. According to the Associated Press, Fayette County officials argued in a court filing that the state did not have the authority to force it to count the undated ballots, adding that the state had missed the deadline to appeal a county board decision. The county also cited ongoing litigation before the Supreme Court, which has yet to rule on the merits of the appellate court ruling. It's unclear which way the Supreme Court may rule. Only Justices Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch dissented in the earlier emergency order, arguing that the lower court ruling was very likely wrong. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, defended the appellate court ruling after Samuel Alito's dissent. ACLU attorney Ari Savitsky said in a statement, "Every vote matters and every valid vote should be counted. Voters may not be disenfranchised for a minor paperwork error like this one." The Third Circuit was correct in unanimously reaching that conclusion. "We are thrilled for these votes that their ballots can finally now be counted, consistent with the requirements of federal law." Matthew Weil, the director of the Elections Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, said in a statement the dates on the absentee ballot envelopes neither help determine whether a voter is eligible nor whether the ballot was cast by the deadline. He said, "Exploiting inconsequential errors or omissions to invalidate otherwise eligible ballots received by the deadline is poor policy and bad for democracy. The fact that the state already accepts ballots with incorrect or invalid dates only demonstrates how inconsequential this requirement is to determine the voters and the ballot's eligibility." Democratic election lawyer Mark Elias warned that the situation in Pennsylvania is far more disturbing than those we have seen elsewhere. Mark Elias noted that the three counties have a combined population of over 1 million people, and the issue causing the counties to contest the results has been fully litigated in both federal and state courts. He said, "Most importantly, these counties did not refuse to submit any election results at all. Worse, they submitted results that intentionally exclude lawful votes," adding that this is how Republicans are planning to steal elections in the future. Nonpartisan election law experts agreed that the trend could cause chaos on a larger scale. Robert Yablon, a law professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, told the New York Times, "Had this unfolded on this kind of timeline in 2020, it really could have created problems because there would have been questions about whether the state could have actually named a slate of electors." Robert Yablon added, "You could imagine there being disputed slates of electors that were sent to Congress and it could have been a big mess.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrowshahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is The Teacher, an introduction to the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, scholars, and ulama. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Dr. Fakh Rouhani. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Dr. Fakhwani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum and thank you.
At the very beginning of this program, I would like to express my condolences on behalf of myself and all the staff of Call of Islam page, IRIB English Radio, for the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. That's why I decided to dedicate this series of the program in the month of Muharram and Safar to the scholars whose one of works, at least, is about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Qaini Mujtahid Birjandi, mainly also known as Muhammad Baqir Ayati and Muhaddis Birjandi, the author of the magnum opus Kibrit Ahmar fi Sharayat al-Manba. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the biography of Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Also, I would like to express my condolences on the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his loyal companions. Regarding Ayatollah Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi, we have to say that this outstanding sheikh is born to a religious family in one of the villages of Birjand, which is located in the east of Iran. Then when he was 12 years old, he goes to Qa'en, actually the the closest place for the studying near to their villages. And then from there, he moves to three religious cities, starting from Mashhad. Then till he is 20 years old, he stays in Mashhad. And then from then, he goes to Najaf, stays for a couple of years over there, benefiting from the great ulama, Mirza Habibullah Rashti.
Yes.
And also Marhum Akhund Khurasani, you know, to have the name of these great scholars as your teachers, it will express that where you are, I mean, how you have benefited from the knowledge of the great ulama of Islam. And then he moves to Samira. So we have a sheikh who has compiled the experiences and knowledge yes. of the scholars of three main cities for yes. Shias, namely Mashhad, Najaf, and also Samira. And when he was in Samira, he benefited from the founder of the seminary of Samira, Mirza
Shirazi. Mirza Shirazi, Mirza, that's right.
Yes, and then okay. he comes back, when he is done with his study, he comes back to Iran and start his lessons and also going up the member. And the main book that today, inshallah, we have dedicated our program with, Kibritul Ahmar fi Shara'at al-Member, is talking about the rituals, customs, and
That's
the
right.
adab
yes.
of the member, all for the one who is going up the member
yes.
and those who are benefiting from the member.
They say that he had also mastery over the fatwas, we can say, verdicts of the other denominations of Islam up to an extent that he establishes dialogue and conversations with them, answering them based on their own reasonings and their own books. It shows that he was really a high caliber Ayatollah and Shaykh on that time. But as I said, since we are in the month of Muharram and we want to talk more about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we are looking for an excuse to talk about him. What the best excuse than an author who compiled a work, or it's better to say his magnum opus, on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Dr. Fakhrouhani, Kibrit al-Ahmar fi Sharaat al-Minbar, we can say is the outstanding work of this man, Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi. What is this book exactly?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sallallahu alayki wa abdullah, assalamu alayki wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. One of the outstanding features of the Shia denomination in the whole Islamic world is that a member isn't merely a pulpit or isn't merely a podium for delivering lectures. Rather, member is a place or a space given to a high-ranking cleric, Shia cleric, in order to educate people. In order to give them informal education, because I mean, education can be divided into formal education as one may receive in high schools or universities, in contrast to informal education, which can be gained, I mean, in the mosques, masajid, or Husseinias, and so on. From this perspective, it must be indicated that when such a great dignitary like the late Ayatollah Qaini Birjandi, I mean, dedicated a book on the, I mean, qualifications or the necessary traits that any cleric must have in order to deliver a set of lectures on religious topics. That's right. I mean, while ascending to member, it indicates that this space shouldn't be left without its own standards. Rather, yes, it must be quite well-disciplined.
Especially when it is about Imam al-Hussein, yes, alayhi salam, certainly. Because the passionate aspect of, yes, the story of Karbala
and
are there.
It proves more, influential,
yes,
for people.
Yes.
Okay? Because, I mean, ordinary people may not accept anything when you say to them in the street. However, when they receive the same piece of information while listening to a lecture given to them from, yes, the top of a member, okay, they would, I mean, in a great majority of cases, they accept.
Okay.
In this book, I mean, Kibrit Ahmar has got two main sections.
Yes.
Two major sections. One of them is concerned with the qualifications and status of member, and another one is the benefit and the virtues of giving advice to other people.
That's,
I mean,
right,
all, I mean, backed and supported by Quranic verses or, I mean, authentic hadiths. And then another one, I mean, the second chapter of the book talks about who may have the qualification, the right qualification, both from the point of piety or from the point of knowledge, to ascend a member in order to deliver a lecture from there.
That's all right.
The third chapter of the book talks about...
So there are two parts. Part one consists of four chapters.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Chapter three talks about the qualifications expected from the audience to have. I mean,
yes,
they must be ready. They must be a state of alacrity in order,
yes,
to receive these lectures.
Okay.
And mainly, I mean, what must be observed in any commemorative session held in memory of the Ahl al-Bayt. And the fourth chapter of the book talks about, I mean, various qualifications expected from a well-designed member,
yes,
in order to be,
okay,
influential for people.
That's all right.
Yes.
And the second part, I think we have,
yes,
some pieces of,
okay,
advice, you know, how to,
yes,
preach for Imam al-Hussein or something like that.
Yes. In the second part of the book, three important, topics or, standards are given in that, okay, how, for example, the
orator,
sad aspects,
yes,
of,
okay,
the life and times of the infallibles should be given.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is concerned with some other characteristics are concerned with the guidance oriented aspects of delivering lectures and how to manage
Direct.
Yes.
A nice ceremony for Imam al-Hussein.
Yes. For example, university professors, when they enter their own classes, must be able how to start the lecture, how to develop the topic, and how to come to a conclusion at the end of the session.
That's all right.
لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان
شيخ مهتبي. So we can say in this way the member and giving a speech on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on a pulpit, but the orators and we can say the speakers and the presenters, is really a serious task, as Ayatollah Bijandi believed in, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. That is a serious task, and it gives more emphasis when we look at the position of Ayatollah Bijandi. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some average level scholars may author some books regarding Imam Hussein, but when you see a scholar who has reached the level of ijtihad and got permission from outstanding scholars like Mirza-i Shirazi for the ijtihad, then under the supervision of his ustad, that it is because it is mentioned that Mirza-i Shirazi is indicating, or it's better to say Mirza-i Shirazi is offering that with this knowledge and this skill for you, it's better to start writing. Mm-hmm. And when he offers the first copy of his book, not specifically this book, but the one of the book, because his books reach 70 volumes in different fields of studies.
Yes.
So with this position to master different knowledges and different sciences regarding the religious sciences, you see, we have the book regarding the how to observe the conditions and situation in relation to Minbar al-Hussein.
Or Majlis al-Hussein.
Yes, or Majlis al-Hussein. So it will emphasize the position of this point.
Yes.
That is not an easy task to be taken by any scholar any level.
So you mean it needs its own experts in order to go on member and give a speech, and not any maybe not any type of, we can say, a scholar or an alim is capable or talented enough or powerful enough in a speech to give on member, especially in the case of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which we can say has the passion and the knowledge and the historical, we can say, knowledge is very much needed.
And sometimes we see that there are some distortion
taken
place,
and distortions,
in the history of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his martyrdom and his loyal companions. So you have to reach the level of expertise in order to differentiate between the truth and false stories. That's why we see one of the subjects that he deals with in his book is about the distortions.
That's right. Continuing the path of his master, Muhaddis Nuri, on the book Lolo Var Marjan, Lolo and Marjan, because that book was also about answering such deviations and distortions which found their way into the story of Karbala and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And unfortunately, sometimes on the manaber and the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are being reiterated, which are absolutely wrong. And Muhammad Baqir Birjandi, can say, tries to answer such deviations, distortions, and misunderstandings about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Kibrit Ahmar fi Sharait al-Manbar. What does Kibrit Ahmar refer to over here in this title?
Yes, this Kibrit al-Ahmar, as we have the equivalent in English, Kibrit al-Ahmar, better to explain it for our listeners, means that stone that magician were looking after in order to change copper into gold. So it's a metaphoric name, although it's got its literal meaning, red sulfur.
Yes.
But the metaphorical meaning of that is that stone that they were looking after in order to change copper into gold.
So you mean Muhammad Baqir Mirjandi can say...
To make a shortcut to for make something, a shortcut. Yes.
Okay. If someone wants to get a member...
Yeah.
And being a nice presenter on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he needs to make his copper into a gold, isn't it?
Yes, and whatever he is in need of, in he need can of. Find it.
Okay.
Find it
in order to
book.
Improve yourself, is better to say. That's all right. Really nice title. Dr. Fakhwani, anything missed about this book or Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Bijandi?
One point is that, I guess, I mean, synopsis of the book, or for yes. example, a brief version of these books should be put into English.
Yes.
Because, yes. I mean, nowadays we find that in English-speaking nations, some Shia orators ascend members or go to the podium in order to deliver lectures.
Yes. Okay? Yes.
And in order to prevent them from making some inadvertent mistakes, it's necessary to provide them with this kind of experience, again, related or, for example, reported in this region of the world. Perhaps some of these, yes. I mean, anecdotes or suggestions may help them not to go astray yeah. while delivering such lectures. Yes.
Especially nowadays that the members are replaced yes. with some of the virtual, we can say, on the social media member or something like that. But we know that the member for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam needs its own qualifications, the starting point, we can say, the stories that are mentioned, even the eulogies and the elegies and the lamentations that are done for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam have their own etiquettes. Yes. So all of these etiquettes have to be observed according to religious laws and Islamic laws. And if they are not observed truly, they are deviated from the right path.
Certainly.
That's all right.
Thank you
much, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhwani and Sheikh Mahtavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, about Muhammad Baqir Bijandi, the author of the magnum opus, Kibrit al-Ahmar fi Sharait al-Minbar, which was about the best qualifications, or better say, attributes of giving a good lecture on the minbar about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This outstanding man, that is the late Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Bijandi, passed away on Zulhijjah 14, the year 1352, according to the lunar Hijri calendar, at the age of 56. His body, we can say, was taken to a Madrasa Ilmiya, or Islamic school, Islamic seminary of the Birjand called Masumiya, and he was buried in a special chamber or gravesite, which is, we can say, place for them, and he was buried in the school, in the same school. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man and all the people who dedicated their lives to write and to work on the Islamic sciences, Islamic knowledge, especially about Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam, this true legacy for the whole Muslim world to learn from and to benefit from. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, to another episode and introducing another Shia dignitary who compiled a work, at least, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. God bless you all. Fi amanillah. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah al-Hussein.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.